Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021.
Today, cost of capital. The subject will spill, of course, into the lecture on Wednesday, and there should be... This is not a terribly complicated subject at all, but there's kind of a conceptual part that can... It takes a while for it to soak in, and do write down the definitions that I give you, because I'm kind of building towards something as I do these through this lecture. Anyway, a quick look at the numbers. We had another record day on Wall Street, and as you can see, the Dow was up not much, but the S&P was up respectable, 0.5%, and the NASDAQ came in at a little under 1%. It's classic, the greater risk had the larger return. Now, an interesting thing about this, well, first of all, let me go over here. Crude lost... You know what? This is driving me crazy. They've got so much... Give me a second here. They got so much crap on that Yahoo ad with ads and twitching videos and all that, that it crashes Firefox now a little bit. So what I'm going to do is let me do this. I'll use Edge, which I found out is actually a pretty darn decent browser, especially when you're working in on NFT and crypto sites. Okay, here we go. Crude was down a little bit. Nothing, I mean, 17 cents. That doesn't mean it's good times ahead. We are going to get to $90 a barrel here. And so just stay tuned. Now, interestingly, gold and silver were up some. Now, that's not as interesting as what comes next. Bond yields were down 2 basis points, which means prices were up. Okay, so money was flowing into bonds. Money was flowing into metals. And money was flowing into equities. So essentially, money was flowing into everything. Now that is happy, happy times when you see that kind of... investors just willy-nilly buying stuff, buying stocks, as you see here on the first panel, and then buying gold and silver on the second panel, and buying bonds on the third panel. Apparently, this was take your happy pills week. Now, does this mean that the end is near? Probably not, but still, you never know. But we are reaching one high after another, and like I said, this was record. We've broken the records now, again. And it was interesting because early this morning, the futures markets for these were kind of like just nothing was happening. It was almost like everyone was taking a breather. But apparently, the schoolyard had milkshakes, so everyone goes to the schoolyard for the milkshakes again, even though they were exhausted from last week's rises. So there you are. Let me do something here. Now, again, of course, you see this greater risk, greater expected return, all that. And this sounds like something that's sort of like a saying or a theory, and you see this evidence of it. I want to take you somewhere here for a few minutes. I'm going to have to... I try to put my bookmarks here on this computer, and every night they have some sweep that gets rid of anything that the university doesn't think is appropriate, so all my bookmarks go away. So I have to do this way. Come on. I'll do it this way. Come on. What the? Okay. This site is called onestockone.com. If I remember, I'll put it in the scrolling marquee on my podcasting site, isu-prof.com. This place, I've been using it for a long time. And last semester, it was last spring semester when we were still Zoom, I had all my stuff I was doing it from my home studio. And I went to show this to the students, and it was gone. I mean, the site was not there. 404 error. I thought, my God, this was such a vast repository. People have been using this for years, and apparently some DDoS attack cleaned it, and then they brought it back after the smoke had cleared. What you've got here is yearly financial, the stock data, and indexes data, going back to 1975, in some cases earlier than that. You got the classic DJI, Dow Jones Industrial Average, S&P, NASDAQ. You've got stocks, as many as you could imagine, historical prices and rates of return year over year for years. You can go and look at world markets. You've got everything from Serbia to Japan to Canada to Portugal, Indonesia. You got Hong Kong. No matter where you want to go, here's data. Just glorious, glorious data. And so you can do some pretty awesome things here with this, all the stuff that you've got here. I'm going to do something here. Part of this is to show you some Excel, and part of it is to show you a result that's going on here that you'll see, and to make some quick comments about statistics and all that. But now there's a way in Excel that's used to be very good, and it worked to retrieve data. It was a data harvesting tool. They screwed it up over the years to the point where it really doesn't work as well as it used to. In other words, I could tell Excel, go get this data. And every time I open it, go find the data again, see if there's anything different. It was an awesome little tool. It was, but it's not as good as it used to be. And it can really screw up when you do it nowadays. Basically, suppose that I wanted to get, and I'm going to show it to you, and then I'm going to do it another way. Here is one stock one. Look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow 30 as they call it now. Since 1975, prices at the beginning of the year, end of the year, up or down, and the one we want is the percent gain or loss. In other words, the yield, yearly yield, all those years. Now, it used to be, and I'll show you how to do this, but I don't expect it to work. Or work well. For one thing, one problem is they've got so many firewalls here at ISU, it's ridiculous. But I'm going to copy the address, the URL of the data set. And I'm going to go in here and I'm going to try to harvest the data. Data. Get the data from the web. And it's probably not going to work, I'm assuring you. Okay, here's the URL. Now, it's going to say, do you want this data? I want this data, you fool. Now, here's where it sucks. It used to show you a picture of the different data sets. Now it's saying, well, what do you want? The whole document? Table 0, table 1? What the hell is the table that you're asking? So you can guess. Okay, here it is. Fortunately, table 1 was the data. Okay, now. Load it. Here's where it gets nasty. It brings it up in a really ugly table that can cause you all kinds of grief. Don't do that. You've got all these little drop-down menus and all this kind of stuff, so you can do pivoting with it and all that. You don't really want to do that with this. So I'm going to close this, and I'm going to do it the easy way, the ancient way. Okay, file, new. Watch how we do it. I'm going to say, okay, let me go over here. Here's the data. I'm just going to copy it. Control C, and then go over here, Control V. There it is. See how clean it is? It's just nice data here. Now, all I really want, I don't need these. I need just the year and the yields, the annualized yield, annual yields. Okay, so get rid of those and spread it out. Okay, so now I've got the Dow. Okay. As a matter of fact, let me add a insert. Now bold, and then we'll go center. Okay. So now, let me go back there, and I'm going to go back, and now let me get the Standard & Poor's 500. Control C to copy it, go over here, and I'm going to put it here, Control V. Okay, so now I don't need these. All I need is the yields. So I'll delete that, and I'll put in here S and P 500. Whoops, that was a disaster. Okay. Bold it and then widen it up. Okay, now I'm going to do one more here. I'm going to get the NASDAQ and bring it back. Oh, there it is. Okay, so now we just copy all that data. You notice that the data harvesting method used to be great, but this way doesn't suck. I mean, it's just gather the data, and then you can let Excel do your legwork for you. So I'm going to do Control V, get rid of all this, delete it. By the way, this is actually something of an art. Some of you are going to live in a world where you have to gather data a lot. And what I'm doing here is called parsing. Data parsing. It's just cleaning up the data, getting the unneeded vectors out. Now, Excel, they've got this word called array. If you want to sound sophisticated, you call them data vectors. Okay, so now, we've got the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ. We've got the annual returns, gain or loss, from 1975 to 2020. So what can we do with this fun information that we've got? Well, we can find the average, the median, the standard deviation, and the coefficient of variation. And if you don't remember what these are, that one is. I'll bring it back up. Okay, so now we're going to bold, italic, right flush, and we're going to get these. The average equals average from what? B3 on down. The median is median from B3 to B48. standard deviation is STDEV from B3 to B48. Now, the coefficient of variation, if you don't remember, standard deviation measures spread. There's a problem with that measure of spread, though, because it is completely dependent upon the scale of the numbers. So you could have two standard deviations, or actually the same spread, but if one is numbers in millions and the other is numbers in thousands, they would not have the same standard deviation. The standard deviation of the numbers in millions would be huge compared to the standard deviation of the one in thousands. So the coefficient of variation actually adjusts for the different scale. What you do is you take equals the standard deviation divided by the average. By the way, the standard deviation is a percentage too. Let me fix that. Percentage. Okay, and I'm going to fix coefficient variation to 4 decimal places. Okay, so there we go. Now, let's look at, this is the Dow. Now, let's look at the Standard & Poor's and the NASDAQ. Whoops, didn't mean to do that. I wanted to grab that little crop. There it is. Okay, look at this, the Dow, the lowest expected return and the lowest standard deviation and the lowest coefficient of variation. The riskier Standard & Poor's, a higher return over the past 45 years and a higher risk measured by standard deviation and coefficient of variation. The NASDAQ, the very highest return, but also the highest standard deviation and the highest coefficient of variation. Well, I'll be darned. The greater the risk, the greater the return. Funny, that's sort of our mantra in finance. It's not a theory, it's not an opinion, it's not just an old saying. Here it is, with the hard data for 45, nearly half a century. I could take this back. There are some places it's a little harder to get to, but I could take you back many more years, nearly a century, you'd see it. Now, here's an interesting thing, though. And I found out that I don't know whether it was taught to you and it wasn't big, so you just kind of push it out of your mind, or if it wasn't taught to you. The average and the median. You see, if a distribution is actually a normal distribution, it will be a perfectly symmetric bell curve. The mean and the median will be identical. They will be the same. If you look at this, though, they're not. Here's how you look at it. Here's how you think about it. Okay, suppose that I give a test. I've given a test. And I find that the average is a 75, but the median is a 68. That's a very useful thing. What would that mean? Were you taught this, what it means when you have the median below or above the mean, the average? Here's what it means. If in a case like this, which happens sometimes, if I have the average at 75, and then if I have the median, I'm sorry, let me say median at 75, but the average is 68, that means that there was a tail of very low scores, abnormally low scores. They pulled the average down because that adds up all the numbers and divides by the number of data points. The median doesn't care whether it's a big high number or a small high number. It's just halfway point. Okay, so the median would not be affected by super low scores. Similarly, in some classes, what I'll have, this is especially true in some subjects, I'll have the average at 75, but I will have the median at 75, but the average will be in the low 80s. And of course, what that does is that blows the curve. Well, see, some people really did well on this test. I mean, the average of 60 is really great. All that means is that you had some super high performers. You had a cluster of hundreds and 98s. If you have the average way above the median, that simply means that you had some really high scores that distorted the overall picture of the distribution. What does that mean here? Look at the Dow. Do you see how the median, the halfway, half the day is above it, half is below it, is above the average? So that's true also for the Standard & Poor's 500. Do any of you want to take a stab at why that would be? Well, that's the black swan effect. You see, black swans are massive crashes. So if you have black swans, they'll drag the average down. They won't drag the median down because you've got everything else is normal. It's just a couple of super low. It wouldn't have mattered if the crash had been 30% or 4% below the average. It still wouldn't, that's all it would have done is just left it the average lower, but the median would have stayed the same. So you notice that the Dow and the Standard & Poor's 500 both are sensitive to the black swans. But look at that. The NASDAQ does not have a black swan effect. Well, that tells us that the NASDAQ stocks, those small scrappy stocks, they don't crash. You have a crash, that's a media event. The Dow drops 1,000 points. Everyone's going to run to the hills. Kill yourselves. No, all it's saying is that the big, huge companies of the earth, the Dow companies, the S&P 500 companies, crashed. And all the small companies are saying, what happened? Sort of like that meteorite that hit about 60 million years ago. It blew away all those ginormous dinosaurs. The rats stuck up. What the hell happened, man? That's exactly the same effect that's going on here. Small companies. So in other words, if there's a crash of the market and you really want to pee your pants, get this, if you've got a small stock portfolio, leave them alone for God's sake. But more importantly, look at something here. You buy and hold. You buy and hold. These numbers here are the result of, okay, you would have had the crash in the late 80s, another crash, a little mini crash in the 90s. You would have had a hella crash in 2008. But look, if all you do is just stop peeing yourself and just buy and hold, and don't panic when the news media says the world is coming to an end, it's not. It just isn't. You're going to be fine over the long haul. How fine are you going to be? Well, let me show you something here. Let's take $10,000. Okay, now. Let's take that $10,000 as an absolute reference point times 1 plus the average rate of return to the number of years Whoops, didn't mean to do that. Try that again. Minus A3. Absolute reference. I'm doing this a little bit fancy, just so you can see it. How much would you have had if you put $10,000 in the bank in 1975? If you had put it into the Dow 30 portfolio, just the Dow 30 stocks, you'd have that much. Well, what if you'd put it into the S&P 500 portfolio? You would have had that much. Nice little retirement nest. What if you decided to throw it to the wind into the NASDAQ? Hello Kitty. Look at that. That's a risky-ass portfolio, but, I mean, this takes into account the crashes and the booms and all that. You would have been able to buy some friends in your old age. I can't do that. All I can do is talk to my cats. And even then, I have to hang a pork chop around my neck so they'll talk to me. There you go. But you see, what we're trying to convey here in finance is that there's this kind of gloom and doom kind of thing. Oh, this is all so complicated, and it's all just theory anyway, man. And I can buy and sell and day trade and buy myself a whole bunch of computers and maybe do some crypto stuff. The story is the same as it's always been. You buy and hold. You do this responsibly. Put a little chunk of money in to start the whole thing if you've got some inheritance or something. And then just put some money in along the way. And don't panic. That's the whole thing. I wish I could take you through some of our best training in the military. Our job was to make our enemy panic, to freak them out, to confuse them, to make them scatter, because then we win. We just take them out. And I won't say we kill them because that would be hurtful. But you see, this whole thing, let other people panic. Let other people scatter. You just hold on and look at that. You could be almost about $5.5 million better if you just put money in now and leave it there. Sure, you're not going to be able to buy cheeseburgers and other fun stuff, but at the same time, trust me, you'll appreciate it more when you're in your old age anyway. Okay, you got it? Let me make a little point here about standard deviations. And again, this is something that I have the kind of questions on this that tell me that it wasn't emphasized or it wasn't shown to you. Whenever you've got a distribution that's kind of pretty much normal, there's your average right there, the center point. Now, what is the good of the standard deviation? It's actually useful. And if you take a corporate management class from me, I will show you some really nice uses of this for budgeting purposes. But you see, running out of room on markers here. From one standard deviation above to one standard deviation below, a normal distribution, that will be 67% of the events will occur in there. From up to down, 67% of the time, you'll be in that band. So I could take like the Dow there, and I could subtract 14.82 from 9.92, and then add 14.82 to 9.92, and I would know that about 67% of the time, I'm going to land in that area, somewhere in there. I also know that from positive 2 to negative 2 standard deviations, 95% of the events will occur. 95% of the events will occur. And this gives you, for one thing, what it does is it says, okay, what for me would be an anomalous, an unusual, a worrisome event? Most of the time in research, we take 95% as the confidence interval. If it's anywhere within this band of 95%, it's normal. It's nothing big. It's only if it falls outside of that band on the top or the bottom that we say, that's interesting. That's something that shouldn't have happened. Okay, and that's very much the way we work in scientific research all the time. We have a null hypothesis that nothing happened. There was no effect. And so it has to get more than 95%. In other words, it has to get out here in these tails. If it does, then we say, okay, we did have an effect. If we give a medicine and 95% of, and like all of the people who took it had no treatment effect. But if we see that more than a few show up in one of the tails, we say, ah, something did happen with this. And so that means that we have a quote-unquote statistically significant event. And so we can fail. So in other words, we can categorically reject the null hypothesis. Anyway, enough of that. This is for your benefit, just to give you an idea of what we mean by risk and return and by what's going to go on later in the course as we go on. Let me take this off the board. Cost of capital. This lecture is about the cost of capital. Now, some terminology to begin this. Cost of capital. The capital structure. Capital structure is a combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises capital structure. Capital structure that comprises total assets, I'm sorry. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises your total assets. So in other words, if you've got $1 million in assets and your debt is $400,000, your equity is $600,000, then your capital structure is 40% debt, 60% equity. That's all it is. Nothing fancy about it.
Oh, this needs something a little stronger.
Okay. Now, there are two components to capital. There's debt, obviously, and then there's equity, obviously. Now, each of them has a cost. Your debt has a cost. It's pretty obvious. At least it's sort of obvious. Your coupon, you pay 8%, that's your cost of debt. But in finance, we consider your equity to be a cost too. In accounting, profit is all good. In finance, it's good, but it's also bad because your equity is a cost to you. You make money at the bottom line. The corporation makes money. That belongs to the shareholders. That's not yours as the corporation. It is owed to the shareholders, either through dividends or through plowback. It is a cost. And that's one of the things that's kind of hard, a difficult hurdle to jump people over. The idea that everything in this world has a cost. Nothing is free, and equity profit is costly. In fact, as a general rule, equity is ridiculously more expensive than debt. And I'll go through in just a little bit here the question, why in the world would any company sell stock? It's so darned expensive compared to borrowing money. It just, at first glance, it doesn't make any sense at all. And it was an interesting final debate that happened some years ago in among finance professionals and academics, where we actually kind of faced what was going on. But to begin, R sub D is the cost of debt. But you see, debt, there are two big reasons debt is cheaper than equity. First of all, debt is safer. If I don't pay my debt holders, they'll wipe me out. They'll just destroy me. So I am going to really, really try my best to pay them their interest expense. The shareholders, if I don't give them a dividend, what are they going to do? Stomp their feet and pee on my wall? No. Well, yeah, maybe they will. But who cares? But there's another critical part to this. On an income statement, you have revenue minus cost of goods sold. That gives you your gross income. Minus your selling, general, and administrative expenses. Minus your depreciation expense. That gives you your earnings before interest and taxes, your operating income, as it's sometimes called. Then you subtract your interest expense, and you get pre-tax, EBT, earnings before taxes. You'll hear me call that pre-tax. Oh, wait, what the hell? Minus taxes gets you your net income. Wait, there's a problem here. You mean you get to deduct your interest expense? Yep. Interest expense is a tax shield. That's a tax shield. The shield is the interest expense times the tax rate of the company. That's the shield right there, the interest expense. So in other words, what really matters is not the cost of debt, it's the after-tax cost of debt, which is the pre-tax times 1 minus the tax rate of the corporation. Isn't that interesting? You see, there's a nasty, nasty, dark side to this. See, corporations and individuals, households, get that tax deduction. So let's say that you have a family, two families. You have family A is in the 15% marginal tax bracket. Family B is in the 30% tax bracket. Let's say they both get a home loan for 8%. Let's do 6%. The after-tax cost of the debt to the low income is 6% times 1 minus 0.15, which is 5.1%. For the wealthy family in the higher tax bracket, it's 6% times 1 minus 0.30, which is 4.2%. Well, I'll be darned. The rich people benefit more than the poor. So in other words, the working class is more likely, because of the tax punishment, the differential tax punishment, to live in apartments, where they don't have as many rights against search and seizure, where they don't have any home-owning building up of equity, where they will allow the whole neighborhood to go to hell because they don't have a stake, so why should they care what happens downstairs? And that's how our tax system works. Corporations are the same way. My little corporation, its debt is just not very attractive. For ginormous corporations, yeah, they'll take on very large amounts of debt. And if they don't pay it, well, whole cities can go into the crater like Detroit did. But if I went into a crater with debt, who cares? But you see, so we're going to encourage massive corporations to take on massive amounts of debt because of the tax shield that is higher than it is for small corporations. The same was true of all the giant, the 10 biggest, too big to fail banks. They were so friggin' leveraged with that tax shield encouraging them to take on more and more debt that they basically have been zombies for the last, 20 years. Yeah, they've been zombies. They've been dead all that time. And the government has shoveled in, at this point, about $18 trillion to keep those zombies alive while their owners, like Jamie Dimon, trot around and strut and fret their hour upon the stage and everyone crawls to them. They're dead. Why? Because they have, part of it was, the encouragement of huge corporations to take on massive debt loads, and then they can't handle them. And then they either go bankrupt and whole cities go down into the hell, or the government takes over and essentially takes care of them with corporate welfare forever. Okay. Enough of that. Let me kill this. Actually, I had that calculator to do that, and I did it myself anyway. I hope I got that. Well, anyway. Okay, so here's the next thing. Equity. The problem is that there are... let me point out something about debt here. Corporate debt. I almost forgot. Jeez. Okay. Now, as a first pass, well, what's the cost of debt for this corporation? Oh. Well, one thing you could do is look at the bond. Well, it's an 8% coupon bond, so that's the cost. Not really, because there are two problems. One is that the coupon is what the cost of debt was at the time of issue of the debt instrument. It's better if you use the yield to maturity. So I might have an 8% coupon bond, but its yield to maturity might be like 8.15. So that would be more like the actual cost of debt right now if the company needed more. In other words, the marginal cost of debt. It might even be a little more than that because that would be the cost of the existing debt. If they get some more, it might be even more. But then there's another problem, and this was something that it really never occurred to me until I actually... was going to do one as a practical exercise, and I realized, this company, it was like some company like CVS, I think, they don't have one bond. They have like 10 or something like that. Senior subordinated, junior subordinated, debentures, mortgage bonds. Which one do I use? And then it occurred to me, well, that's obvious. You use the one with the highest yield because that would be the worst case scenario. So in other words, when I was looking at CVS, I think it was CVS, they had like yields that were in the range from like 5.2% clear up to almost 8%. And it was, so you choose the one that's the highest because that's probably where they would end up having to borrow money if they had to borrow money right now. It would be some junior subordinated bond that they'd have to issue because they've already got all these senior paper out there. I can't remember if CVS was one or not, but yeah, so you're probably going to want to use a yield to maturity just as a realistic matter. That's where their next cost would be. Equity is nasty because you have the cost of preferred and you have the cost of common. So you have two different. Now, the cost of preferred is going to be super low, but no one uses it. Now, here's what's bad about common. There are two commons, not the classes. There is your existing common, R sub S, and then there is your new common, R sub N, cost. Your existing shareholders are not going to be as expensive as your new shareholders. Ten years ago, you friended me on Facebook. You just don't pay any attention to me. You're just, lol, I've got a friend on Facebook. But now you want to have this new person as your friend. And she's kind of famous. So you're going to have to spend time with her, maybe buy her dinner, buy her gifts. You see, because you need to bring her in. This is how it works with equity in stockbrokers. Facebook have, at the time, maybe a $50 per share price. Well, you see, the investment bankers are going to sell your stock, but they're going to keep money, maybe $5. So you're going to have $50 on your book per share that you got, but you got only $45. Do you see how that makes them more expensive? I'll tell you a story. Now, this is a wild story. It's not as one of those, well, I did something incredible. It's actually, it fell through. But it has to do with, there is actually a movie that was tangentially involved with this, which I didn't know at the time. Oh, we found it out very soon after. Now, back in my, when I was in the really heavy thing of consulting, I worked with some young men who were the representatives of families that had a lot of money that they needed to get into legitimate enterprises. That's not to say that they had illegitimate enterprises. That's just to say that they had illegitimate enterprises. Okay? And we got a call that there was a possibility of a real good play. Had a lot of chance. And I was the numbers guy, but for some reason, it set it up. Back in that time, airports were not like they are now. There weren't these tubes you walk through. You just drove into an airport, you parked your car, you walked up to the planes and all that. It was great back then. It was glorious. But we had gotten this goat into the airport in Atlanta. In the back areas, this vast football field sizes of areas, there were jets, parts of jets, prop planes, parts of prop planes, a few burn marks on the ground, and there were a whole bunch of trailers where people lived or their small-time airplane operations were centered. Well, there was this big old trailer, huge trailer. It was a dark part. There weren't any lights anywhere near it. And we came up there, the two Momo boys and I did, and we parked quite a ways away. We were going to do it. It was a game we were going to play. We knew we were going to play it, so here's how it worked. We went in there. The guy, there were just stacks of papers and folders and binders all over the place. His idea was there was an airline that had not too far past before that gone out of business. It was called Lufthansa. And they had a bunch of planes. I think there was something like MD-5s, if I remember. But anyway, his idea was, okay, I'm going to get my hands on these MD-5s. We're not going to turn it into a passenger service. We're going to take out the seats, and we're going to put packages in there. The post office, DHL, these smaller-time operations at the time, a lot like FedEx and things like that. We will take packages from city to city as for them, for fee. Sounds like a ridiculous idea. It was a little speculative at the time. Why would any company want to fly packages on some airline that was made to fly packages? Well, it was a good idea, of course, and it's later proved to be. But he said, I want to, he and I got along real well. I was a pilot, and we talked about the vision of the beautiful airplanes and all this kind of stuff. And so he said, well, I'm going to need $5 million to do this. I was looking at the numbers, legit, yeah. About $5 million is what it's going to take to kick this on. I see that he's already got preliminary agreements, letters of intention from the U.S. Postal Service and from at least one private delivery service. Okay. And so the one young man said, okay, we're going to get you $7 million together. And the guy said, no, $5 million. Yeah, $7 million. $5 million for you, $2 million for us. $7 million on your books, but you're going to get only $5 million because we get $2 million. So he would be on the hook for equity for $7 million with the punch of $5 million. Well, he just had a fit. I mean, he was this old guy with a kind of older guy with his big gray beard, piercing blue eyes, and a giant cigar in his mouth. What the hell are you talking about? Oh, damn you, get out of here. Screw you. Unless you're going to give me, I want five, say five, maybe 5.1 for you. So we just got up and we said, thank you, sir, and we left. Walked right out the door. It was a long ways to the car, and that was what we intended, because the one guy and I, we walked fast, and the younger one, who's very attractive, very sweet-talking, nice, good-looking, great kid anyway, he walked a lot slower, of course, because that guy was realizing that was his chance, and it was gone. So sure enough, I heard way back there, Dan, Dan! We just kept walking, and the young man said, guys, let me talk to him. Please, let me talk to him. Whatever, we got to get out of town here. We rented this car. We need to leave. So we talked to him, of course, and he came back. He said, he's good for it. We're good. We're fine. Obviously, we'd scared him. He realized that was the only chance he was going to get, and he was going to be on the hook for $7 million, even though he got $5 million. Good news. Well, unfortunately, the deal did fall through because the FAA found out who he was. Have you ever seen the movie Made in America? He was one of the pilots. See, back in the early 1980s, we wanted to do an illegal operation where we would get ginormous bales of marijuana from Nicaragua, and we would fly them and deliver them to drug dealers on the coast in Louisiana. They would give us the money, and then that would flow over to Iran to buy weapons to take back to Nicaragua to pay the rebels to kill the communist insurgents. It was called the Iran-Contra affair when it blew open. And it was a triangular deal. Well, this guy who we had been talking to was the one that was caught landing in Louisiana. And he said, I'm working for the CIA. And of course, no, of course he wasn't, even though he was. So the whole deal fell through when the FAA found out that he was one of the pilots who had been busted in that whole Iran-Contra triangle deal between Nicaragua, the United States, and Iran through the CIA. We were running through the CIA as a black box operation. If you watch a movie, Made in America, you'll see the whole story. It's very clean. Matter of fact, they depicted all the pilots who were flying those routes, and I'm sure one of them was supposedly this guy. But they didn't give him a name or anything. But, yeah. Yes?
When you say we, are you referring to you as an individual or, like, America?
For what? No, this was the United States. This was the CIA was doing the operation.
Okay.
But you mean as far as the deal with getting the money together? The $7
million? Yeah, I thought you were saying you had something.
No, we were the consultants who were going to get him the $7 million. But the deal fell through before anything happened because the FAA shut down his plan because of what he'd done in the past.
Yeah.
That was what happened. We had it all sealed up. We had the money ready to give him. And then when we found out that the FAA had basically, they'd approved everything. I mean, he had all these forms. He was a genius about planes and the whole thing. But then they found out who he was. They did a simple background check. Yes, he did 4 years for running drugs into Louisiana on a DC-3. And the silly man kept saying, I work for the CIA. And, of course, CIA said, what? It was only in 19, later 1980s, 1985, that the whole thing blew open. And yeah, those pilots were working for the CIA. Oh, watch the movie Made in America. Tom Cruise played the lead role in it, and it's dead on to what happened at the time. My story comes many years later, when he was out of prison, he was much older, and he still loved airplanes, and he was genius. I mean, he did all those forms, all these giant books of the mapping out of the routes and everything for the FAA. They rubber stamped all of it. They said, this is great, until they found out that he was an ex-convict. Oh, well. Let that be a lesson to you. That was my biggest play that almost happened. Well, not my biggest one, but none of them ever came through very well. But anyway, let me get back to here. Okay, so how the hell did I get? Oh, okay, I know. I got on this because of the cost of new equity versus the cost of old equity. Now, there's one interesting thing here. You notice that I don't talk about new versus existing for preferred or debt. The reason is this, and I actually read this, and then I found out it was true. Investment bankers will kill a company. They love it because if, like, a Facebook goes public, they'll take a big chunk of every dollar of sales. But they don't do that with preferred and debt because they're so easy to place. Debt and preferred, they can place within minutes. They don't have to do marketing, tombstones in newspapers and all that kind of silly stuff. They can just place it. Hey, we got, and I saw that in REITs. There was a REIT out of Columbus many years ago that I did some consulting for. And they would want, like, they saw, REITs are real estate things. You buy up properties, at least that's the way they used to be. And they, at one point, it was in Kansas City, there was a little strip mall. It was going to be about $800,000. And they simply called Nomura Securities, which was IBing for real REITs. They said, we need $800,000. It was, even in that time, it was wired from over in Japan in 24 hours. And the debt and the preferred stock certificate went over to Nomura. I mean, it was just like there was no cost involved. So that's why it's only with IPOs. And that's the thing that just blows us away. Selling stock in an IPO is as expensive as F. It is just ridiculously. Why would you do that? Because it's sexy. It's big. I mean, why would you make a ginormous meal when Spam can be taken out of the can and fried in minutes? But that's just me, you know, being a Yeti. Let me show you something. This is what happened some years back. It was a disingenuous question. We knew that there was an answer to it. But we wanted but these two, they were industry and academic both. Modigliani and Miller, don't worry about that, I'll bring it up again. But they posed a rhetorical question. They said, look, debt is cheaper than capital, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so here is capital structure. Here's 100% debt capital structure. Here's 0%. Now, the equity would be obviously 1 minus the debt thing. Okay, so suppose that a company has no debt. Then its weighted average cost of capital, in other words, the weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. Well, if there's no debt, then it would just be the cost of equity. That would be the weighted average cost of capital. If you don't have any debt, then all it is just the cost of equity. 100% equity times the cost of equity. Very expensive stuff. But if you had 100% debt, then the only thing in the weighting would be the cost, after-tax cost of debt. So in other words, why would a company ever have any stock? Because the optimal capital structure, the combination of debt and equity that minimizes weighted average cost of capital would be 100% debt. The optimal capital structure is a combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. Let me do that again. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. If you look at this, there's the minimum right there. Optimal capital structure is 100% debt. So Modigliani and Miller just put out this proposition. They said, well, we obviously see equity. Matter of fact, most companies are primarily equity. How's that happening? This is logical. And of course, where it came down to was this. I'll tell you, in my case of my little company, I have a line of credit so I can buy my materials during the winter, get everything ready for the spring and summer shows and the fall shows. And I have the first $5,000 I borrow is at 8.99%. $5,001 up to $12,000. $10,000 is 12.99%. And then above 12,000 up to 20,000 or whatever it is, I'll never get there, go there, is 19.99%. So in other words, the more I borrow, the more the last dollar I borrow costs. The more I borrow, the more the last dollar I borrow costs. Why is that? Because I'm at greater risk of defaulting. The more I borrow, the more likely it is I'm going to default. I mean, I'm not obviously going to pay. I've got $5,000. That's going to be, no more than about $800 a month to pay. But if I'm up there and I've borrowed $12,000, I've got a lot of money to pay every month, and I might not be able to do it. So the bank is going to charge me more because of the greater risk of default. And the more I borrow, the worse it's going to get. And this is the way it is with every corporation. The more the company borrows, the higher the cost of the last dollar. This was what happened with Netflix. They'd been cruising along, and then they decided, we're going to just throw it all to the wind, $1.2 billion we're going to borrow, so that we have all this money ready to go for every new show, for new content on the fly, we'll have the money. Well, Margaret said, well, yeah, we'll go with it, but we're going to charge you out the ass. Why? Because it is expensive and it is dangerous because you might go tap city. You borrow that first $10 million, $50, $500 million, yeah, we figure you're safe. You want to borrow this much? We're going to charge you a whole lot more because of the default premium. We're going to jack that default premium through the roof because you're dangerous AF right now. So in other words, what happens is that at some point, the cost of debt starts to get higher and higher, and so the WACC begins to turn upward. So in the real world, Modigliani, Miller, linear weighted average cost of capital is actually a curve. And the weighted average cost of capital occurs somewhere between 0 and 100% debt. Now, where is it? That's interesting because it's different for different industries. You'll see some industries where the optimal capital structure is at a very low level of debt. And companies, by the way, bust their butt to stay on the optimal point. I'll talk about that in a minute. But then there are some that are about half and half, and then there are some that can just borrow up to insane amounts of money. Once we understood this, it answered an age-old question. We see different industries that have different scales of operation. Some industries, there are just thousands and thousands of little companies and medium and big companies all fighting together. And then there are some where you see only ginormous companies, and some where you see only medium, mostly. Well, I mean, think about, see over there? That's pizza parlors. See how you have most pizza parlors are actually small, one or small number of operations. That's because their optimal size is being driven by their optimal capital structure, which is mostly equity, not debt. They don't borrow because borrowing is too expensive. And then you have this problem over here. This is something I got to remember to watch this, because I bring up examples that actually the cycle has been longer than your lives right now. But there are some where companies can get to huge scale. Efficiency at huge scale is just a thing. Borrow huge amounts of money and then just grow. But the problem is that this causes too many giant companies. And eventually, some of them go bankrupt because they're competing against each other at such ginormous scale. Industries where we've seen this happen, and I screwed it up in the last class. I said, well, you know one, and of course you wouldn't. It was the airline industry. They go through long cycles of 20 to 40 years where the companies, just ginormous big companies, dominate, but then they have to compete against each other and drive each other's prices down to the point where you have bankruptcies. Back in the time, well, Lufthansa, I just brought up Lufthansa. There were others, Pan American, Pan Am, Eastern, TWA. They were the victims of the scale. They grew huge with high debt loads. And then, of course, because they had to cut their prices to stay in competition with each other, they couldn't pay these ginormous prices, and then the industry contracted, consolidated. There are others. Auto manufacturers went through the same cycle in the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s. But anyway, so there is that part of the story, is the optimal capital structure is different from one industry to another. And one thing that's also important, too, is that once a company has found its optimal capital structure, and it's tedious, and I teach it at a higher level class, but once they have that, they actually will do anything they can to keep it. Think about it this way. Suppose a company is very profitable. It doesn't pay much in dividends, so its retained earnings make it more and more equity loaded. It's not borrowing money because it's got so much, it's profitable. So its equity to debt keeps getting more toward equity and near 0% debt. And that makes the company actually go off its optimal capital structure. So what do they have to do? What they usually do is they just start borrowing money hand over fist and buying their own stock back so that they bring themselves back to their optimal capital structure. The other side of it is companies that have bad times and they're not gathering equity and they don't sell stock. They borrow and they just keep borrowing and they get more and more here. And so they're off their capital structure. I actually saw just not that long ago, a company was doing a seasoned offering. They were selling some stock. They were public anyway. But it said right in the offering, we're selling the stock to return to our optimal capital structure. In other words, they had too much debt, and so they had to sell stock to bring themselves back. They were going to sell stock and pay off some of their debt so that they would bring themselves back this way. More equity, less debt. That's all I have for you. Go home.